bounces past the happy couple and rolls into the gutter. To me, Denny says, "Dude, you want to fetch that for me?" My clothes shredded and gummy with blood, thorns stuck in my face, I trot past the couple and nab the head out of the leaves in the trash. The man yelps and pulls back. And the woman says, "Victor? Victor Mancini, oh my God." She must have saved my life, because I don't know who the hell she is. In the chapel, after I gave up, after we were buttoning our clothes shut, I said to Paige, "Forget fetal tissue. Forget resenting strong women." I say, "You want to know the real reason why I won't fuck you?" Doing up the buttons of my britches, I tell her, "Maybe the reason is I really want to like you instead." And with both hands above her head, making her black harebrain tight again, Paige says, "Maybe sex and affection aren't mutually exclusive." And I laughed, my hands tying my cravat. I told her, "Yes, yes they are." Denny and me, we get to the 700 block of, the street sign says, Birch Street. To Denny pushing the stroller, I say, "Wrong way, dude." I point behind us and say, "My mom's house is back there." Denny keeps pushing, the bottom of the stroller making a growling sound against the sidewalk. The happy couple are drop-jawed, still watching us from two blocks back. I trot along next to him, tossing the pink doll head from hand to hand. "Dude," I say, "turn back around." Denny says, "We have to see the 800 block first." "What's there?" "It's supposed to be nothing," Denny says. "My Uncle Don used to own it." The houses end, and the 800 block is just land with more houses on the block after that. The land is just tall grass, planted all around the edges with old apple trees, the bark all wrinkled and twisting up into the darkness. Inside a bunch of brush, blackberry whips, and scrub, more thorns on every twig, the middle of the land is clear. On the corner is a billboard sign, plywood painted white, with a picture across the top of red brick houses built against each other and people waving from windows with flower boxes. Under the houses, black words say, "Coming soon, Menningtown, country townhouses." Under the billboard, the ground snowed with peeling paint chips. Up close, the billboard is curling, the brick townhouses cracked and faded pink. Denny tips a boulder out of the stroller, and it lands in the tall grass beside the sidewalk. He shakes out the pink blanket and hands me two corners. Between us, we fold it, and Denny says, "If you can have the opposite of a role model, he'd be my Uncle Don." Then Denny flops the folded blanket into the stroller and starts to push the stroller toward home. And I call after him, "Dude, you don't want this rock?" And Denny says, "Those mothers against drunk driving? For sure, they threw a party when they found out old Don Menning was dead." Wind lifts and crushes the tall grass. Nobody but plants lives here now. Across the dark center of the block, you can see the porch lights of houses on the other side. The black zigzags of old apple trees are outlines in between. So I go, "Is this a park?" And Denny says, "Not really." Still walking away, he says, "It's mine." I pitch the doll head at him and say, "For real?" "Since my folks called a couple days ago," he says. And he catches the head and drops it into the stroller. Under the streetlights, past everybody's dark house, we walk. My buckle shoes flashing, my hands stuffed in my pockets. I say, "Dude," I say, "you don't really think I'm anything like Jesus Christ, do you?" I say, "Please say no." We walk. And pushing his empty stroller, Denny says, "Face it, dude. You nearly did sex on God's table. You're already shame spiraling big time." We walk, and the beer's wearing off, and it's a surprise how the night air is so cold. And I say, "Please, dude, tell me the truth. I'm not good and kind and caring or any of that happy horseshit. I'm nothing but a thoughtless, brain-dead loser, dude. That I can live with. This is who I am. Just a puss-pounding, seam-reaming, dog-driving, fucking helpless sex addict asshole, and I can't ever, ever let myself forget that." I say, "Tell me again, I'm an insensitive asshole." Chapter 27. How tonight's supposed to work is I hide in the bedroom closet while the girl's taking a shower. Then when she comes out all shining with sweat, the air steamy and fogged with hairspray and perfume, she comes out naked except for a lacy bathrobe. Then I jump out with some pantyhose stretched over my face and wearing sunglasses, and I throw her on the bed. I put a knife to her throat, then I rape her. Simple as that. The shame spiral continues. Just keep asking yourself, what would Jesus not do? Only I can't rape her on the bed, she says. The spread is pale pink silk and it will spot. And not on the floor because the carpet hurts her skin. We agreed on the floor but on a towel. Not a good guest towel, she said. She told me she'd leave a ratty towel on the dresser, and I'd need to spread it on the floor ahead of time so as not to break the mood. She'd leave the bedroom window unlocked before she got in the shower. So I'm hiding in the closet, naked, with all her dry cleaning sticking to me, the pantyhose over my head, wearing sunglasses, and holding the dullest knife I could find, waiting. The towel spread on the floor. The pantyhose are so hot, my face is running with sweat. The hair plastered to my head starts to itch. Not by the window, she told me, and not by the fireplace. She said to rape her near the armoire, but not too near. She said to try and spread the towel in a high traffic area where the carpet wouldn't show as much wear. This is a girl named Gwen I met in the recovery section of a bookstore. It's hard to say who picked up whom, but she was pretending to read a 12-step book about sexual addiction, and I was wearing my lucky camo pants and cruising her over a copy of the same book, and I figured, what's one more dangerous liaison? Birds do it, bees do it. I need the rush of endorphins to tranquilize me. I crave the peptide phenylethylamine. This is who I am, an addict. I mean, who's counting? In the bookstore coffee shop, Gwen said to get some rope, but not nylon rope because it hurt too much. Hemp gives her an inflamed rash. Black electrical tape would work too, but not over her mouth, and not duct tape. Pulling off duct tape, she said, is about as erotic as getting my legs waxed. We compared our schedules, and Thursday was out. Friday I had my regular sexaholics meeting. No chits for me this week. Saturday I spent at St. Anthony's. Most Sunday night she helped run a bingo game at her church, so we settled on Monday. Monday at 9. Not 8 because she worked until late in the evening, and not 10 because I had to be at work early the next morning. So Monday comes. The electrical tape is ready, the towel spread, and when I leap at her with a knife, she says, "Are those my pantyhose you're wearing?" I twist one of her arms behind her back and put the chilled blade to her throat. For crying out loud, she says, "This is way out of bounds. I said you could rape me. I did not say you could ruin my pantyhose." And with my knife hand, I grab the front edge of her lacy bathrobe and try to tug it off her shoulder. "Stop, stop, stop," she says, and slaps my hand away. "Here, let me do it. You're just going to ruin it." She twists away from me. I ask if I can take off my sunglasses. "No," she says, and slips out of her bathrobe. Then she goes to the open closet and hangs the robe on a padded hanger. But I can hardly see. "Don't be so selfish," she says. Naked now, she takes my hand and presses it around one of her wrists. Then she slips her arm behind her back, turning to press her bare back to me, my dog's nosing higher and higher, and her warm, slick butt cracks gumming me, and she says, "I need you to be a faceless attacker." I tell her it's too embarrassing to buy a pair of pantyhose. A guy buying pantyhose is either a criminal or a pervert. Either way, the cashier will hardly take your money. "Geez, quit whining," she says. "Every rapist I've ever been with has bought his own pantyhose." Plus, I tell her, when you're looking at the pantyhose rack, they have all those colors and sizes. Nude, charcoal, beige, tan, black, cobalt, and none of them come in just head-sized. She twists her face away and groans, "Can I tell you something? Can I tell you just one thing?" I say, "What?" And she says, "Your breath is really bad." Back in the bookstore coffee shop, while we were still scripting, she says, "Make sure and put the knife in a freezer beforehand. I need it to be really, really cold." I ask if maybe we could just use a rubber knife. And she said, "The knife is very important to my total experience." She said, "It's best if you put the edge of the knife to my throat before it gets to room temperature." She said, "But be careful, because if you cut me by accident..." She leaned toward me over the table, jabbing her chin at me. "If you even scratch me, I swear I'll have you in jail before you can put your pants back on." She sipped her herbal chai and set the cup back in its saucer and said, My sinuses would appreciate it if you didn't wear any kind of cologne or aftershave or deodorant with a strong scent, because I'm very sensitive. These horny sexaholic chicks, they have such a high tolerance, they just can't not get banged. They just can't stop, no matter how degrading things get. God, how I love being codependent. In the coffee shop, Gwen lifts her purse into her lap and digs around inside it. "Here," she says, and unfolds a photocopied list of details she wants to include. At the top of the list it says, "Rape is about power. It is not romantic. Do not fall in love with me. Do not kiss me on the mouth. Do not expect to linger after the act. Do not ask to use my bathroom." That Monday night in her bedroom, pressed into me naked, she says, "I want you to hit me." She says, "But not too hard and not too soft. Just hit me enough so I come." One of my hands is holding her arm behind her back. She's grinding her butt into me, and she's got a kick-ass tan little bod, except her face is pale and waxy with too much moisturizer. In the mirrored closet door, I can see her front with my face peeking over her shoulder. Her hair and sweat pools in the crack where my chest and her back press together. Her skin is that hot plastic tanning bed smell. My other hand is holding the knife, so I ask, "Does she want me to hit her with a knife?" "No," she says, "that would be stabbing. Hitting somebody with a knife is stabbing." She says, "Put the knife down and use your open hand." So I go to toss the knife. And Gwen says, "Not on the bed." So I toss the knife on the dresser, and I raise my hand to slap. From behind her, this is really awkward, and she says, "But not in the face." So I move my hand a little lower, and she says, "And do not hit my breasts unless you want to give me lumps. See also cystic mastitis." She says, "How about if you just slap my ass?" And I say, "How about if she just shuts up and lets me rape her my way?" And Gwen says, "If that's how you feel, you can just take your little penis and run along home now." Since she's just out of the shower, her bush is soft and full, not matted down the way it is when you first take off a woman's underwear. My free hand creeps around to between her legs, and she feels fake, rubbery and plastic, too smooth, a little greasy. I say, "What's with your vagina?" Gwen looks down at herself and says, "What?" She says, "Oh, that. It's a femidome, a female condom. The edges stick out like that. I don't want you giving me any diseases." "Is it just me?" I say. "But I thought rape was supposed to be more spontaneous, you know, a crime of passion." "That shows you don't know shit about how to rape anybody," she says. "A good rapist will plan his crime meticulously. He ritualizes every little detail. This should be almost like a religious ceremony." "What happens here," Gwen says, "is sacred." In the bookstore coffee shop, she'd passed me the photocopied sheet and said, "Can you agree to all these terms?" The sheet said, "Do not ask where I work. Do not ask if you're hurting me. Do not smoke in my house. Do not expect to stay the night." The sheet says, "The safe word is poodle." I ask what she means by safe word. If the scene gets too heavy, or if it isn't working for one of us, she says, "You just say poodle," and the action ends. I ask if I get to shoot my wad. "If it's all that important to you," she says. Then I say, "Okay, where do I sign?" These pathetic sexaholic chicks, they're so damn dick hungry. Without her clothes, she looks a little bony. Her skin feels hot and damp, as if you could squeeze out warm soapy water. Her legs are so thin they don't touch until her ass. Her little flat breasts seem to cling to her rib cage. Still holding her arm behind her back, watching ourselves in the mirrored closet door, she has the long neck and the sloped shoulders of a wine bottle. "Please stop," she says. "You're hurting me. Please, I'll give you money." I ask how much. "Please stop," she says, "or I'll scream." So I drop her arm and step away. "Don't scream," I say. "Just do not scream." Gwen sighs and then hauls off and punches. "You moron," she says. "I didn't say poodle." It's the sexual equivalent of Simon Says. She twists back into my grip. Then she walks us over to the towel and says, "Wait." She goes to the dresser and comes back with a pink plastic vibrator. "Hey," I say, "you're not using that on me." Gwen shudders and says, "Of course not. This is mine." And I say, "So what about me?" And she says, "Sorry, next time bring your own vibrator." "No," I say, "what about my penis?" And she says, what about your penis? And I ask, how does it fit into all this? Settling herself on the towel, Gwen shakes her head and says, why do I do this? Why do I always pick the guy who just wants to be nice and conventional? The next thing you'll want to do is marry me. She says, just one time, I'd like to have an abusive relationship, just once. She says, you can masturbate while you rape me, but only on the towel and only if you don't slop any on me. She spreads the towel out around her ass and pats a little place of terry cloth next to her. When it's time, she says, you can put your orgasm right here. Her hand goes pat, pat, pat. Okay, I say, now what? Gwen sighs and sticks the vibrator in my face. Use me, she says. Degrade me, you stupid idiot. Demean me, you jerk off. Debase me. It's not really clear where the switch is, so she has to show me how to turn it on. Then it's buzzing so hard I drop it. Then it's jumping around on the floor, and I have to catch the damn thing. Gwen brings her knees up, and they drop off to each side the way a book drops open, and I kneel on the edge of the towel and work the buzzing tip just inside the soft plastic edges of her. I work my dog with my other hand. Her calves are shaved and taper to curved feet with blue polish on the nails. She's laid back with her eyes closed and her legs spread, holding her hands together and stretched above her head so her breasts pull up into perfect little handfuls. And she says, no, Dennis, no. I don't want this, Dennis. Don't. No, you can't have me. And I say, my name is Victor. And she says to shut up and let her concentrate. And I try to give us both a good time, but this is the sexual equivalent of rubbing your stomach and patting your head. Either I'm focused on her, or I'm focusing on myself. Either way, it's the same as a bad three-way. One of us is always getting left out. Plus, the vibrator is slippery and hard to hang on to. It's heating up and smells acrid and smoky, as if something's burning inside. Gwen opens one eye, just a sliver, squinting down at my flogging the dog, and says, me first. I'm wrestling my dog, I'm snaking Gwen, I'm snaking Gwen. This feels less like I'm a rapist than I'm a plumber. The edges of the femidome keep slipping inside, and I have to stop and pick them out with two fingers. Gwen says, Dennis, no, Dennis, stop, Dennis. Her voice coming up from deep in her throat. She pulls her own hair and gasps. The femidome slips inside, and I just let it go. The vibrator tamps it deeper and deeper. She says to play with her nipples with my other hand. I say I need my other hand. My dice draw up tight and ready to trigger, and I say, oh yeah, yes, oh yeah. And Gwen says, don't you dare. And she licks two fingers. She pins her eyes on mine and works her wet fingers between her legs, racing me. And all I have to do is to picture Paige Marshall, my secret weapon, and the race is over. The second before you trigger, that feeling when your asshole starts to clench, that's when I turn toward the little spot on the towel, Gwen said. Feeling stupid and paper-trained, my white soldiers start to toss, and maybe by accident they misjudge the trajectory and toss across her pink bedspread, her whole big soft, puffy pink landscape. Arc after arc sprays out in hot, cramping gobs of all sizes, all over the spread and the pillow shams and the pink silk bed skirt. What would Jesus not do? Spunk graffiti. Vandalism isn't the right word, but it's the first word that comes to mind. Gwen's collapsed on the towel, panting with her eyes closed, the vibrator humming inside her. Her eyes rolled back in her head. She's gushing between her fingers and whispering, I beat you. She whispers, you son of a bitch, I beat you. I'm tucking myself back in my pants and grabbing my coat. White soldier gobs are hanging all over the bed, the drapes, the wallpaper, and Gwen's still lying there, breathing hard, the vibrator angled halfway out of her. A second later, it slips free and flops around on the floor like a fleshy, wet fish. It's then Gwen opens her eyes. She starts to push herself up on her elbows before she sees the damage. I'm halfway out the window when I say, oh, by the way. I say, poodle. And behind me, I hear her first scream for real. Chapter 28. In the summer of 1642, in Plymouth, Massachusetts, a teenage boy was accused of buggering a mare, a cow, two goats, five sheep, two calves, and a turkey. This is real history in the books. in accordance with the biblical laws of Leviticus, after the boy confessed, he was forced to watch each animal being slaughtered. Then he was killed, and his body heaped with the dead animals and buried in an unmarked pit. This was before there were sexaholic talk therapy meetings. This teenager, writing his fourth step, must have been a whole barnyard tell-all. I ask, any questions? The fourth graders just look at me. A girl in the second row says, "What's buggering?" I say, "Ask your teacher." Every half hour, I'm supposed to teach another herd of fourth graders some shit nobody wants to learn. How to start a fire, how to carve an apple head doll, how to make ink out of black walnuts. As if this is going to get any of them into a good college. Besides deforming the poor chickens, these fourth graders, they all walk around carrying some germ. It's no mystery why Denny's always wiping his nose and coughing. Head lice, pinworms, chlamydia, ringworm. For serious, these field trip kids are the pint-sized horsemen of the apocalypse. Instead of useful pilgrim crap, I tell them how their playground game, Ring Around the Rosie, is based on the bubonic plague of 1665. The Black Death gave people hard, swollen black spots they called plague roses, or buboes, surrounded by a pale ring, hence bubonic. Infected people were locked inside their houses to die. In 6 months, 100,000 people were buried in huge mass graves. The pocketful of posies was what people of London carried around so they wouldn't smell the corpses. To build a fire, all you do is pile up some sticks and dry grass. You strike a spark with a flint. You work the bellows. Don't think for a second this fire-starting routine makes their little eyes sparkle. Nobody's impressed by a spark. Kids crouch in the front row, huddling over their little video games. Kids yawn right in your face. All of them giggle and pinch, rolling their eyes at me and my breeches and dirty shirt. Instead, I tell them how in 1672, the Black Plague hit Naples, Italy, killing some 400,000 people. In 1711, in the Holy Roman Empire, the Black Plague killed 500,000 people. In 1781, millions died worldwide from the flu. In 1792, another plague killed 800,000 people in Egypt. In 1793, mosquitoes spread yellow fever to Philadelphia, where it killed thousands. One kid in the back whispers, "This is worse than the spinning wheel." Other kids open their lunch boxes and look inside their sandwiches. Outside the window, Denny's bent over in the stocks, this time just out of habit. The town council has announced he'll be banished right after lunch. The stocks are just where he feels most safe from himself. Nothing's locked or even closed, but he's bent over with his hands and neck where they've been for months. On their way here from the Weavers, one kid was poking a stick in Denny's nose and then trying to poke the stick in his mouth. Other kids rub his shaved head for luck. Starting the fire only kills about 15 minutes, so after that, I'm supposed to show each herd of kids the big cooking pots and twig brooms and bed warmers and shit. Kids always look bigger in a room with 6-foot ceilings. A kid in the back says, "They gave us fucking egg salad again." Here in the 18th century, I'm sitting beside the hearth of the big open fireplace, equipped with the regular torture chamber relics. The big iron pot hooks, the pokers, andirons, branding irons. My big fire blazing. This is a perfect moment to take the iron pincers out of the coals and pretend to study their pitted, white-hot points. All the kids step back. And I ask them, "Hey kids, can anybody tell me how people in the 18th century used to abuse naked little boys to death?" This always gets their attention. No hands go up. Still studying the pincers, I say, "Anybody?" Still no hands. "For real," I say, and start working the hot pincers open and shut. "Your teacher must have told you how they used to kill little boys back then." Their teacher's outside waiting. How it worked was, a couple of hours ago, while her class was carding wool, this teacher and me wasted some sperm in the smokehouse, and for sure she thought it would turn into something romantic, but hey. Me being face-deep in her wonderful rubbery butt, it's amazing what a woman will read into it if by accident you say, "I love you." 10 times out of 10, a guy means, "I love this." You wear a foofy linen shirt, a cravat, and some breeches, and the whole world wants to sit on your face. The two of you sharing the ends of your fat, hot slider, you could be on the cover of some paperback bodice ripper. I tell her, "Oh, baby, cleave thy flesh unto mine. Oh, yeah, cleave for me, baby." 18th century dirty talk. Their teacher, her name's Amanda or Allison or Amy, some name with a vowel in it. Just keep asking yourself, what would Jesus not do? Now, in front of her class with my hands good and black, I set the pincers back into the fire, then wiggle two of my black fingers at the kids, International Sign Language for, "Come closer." The kids in the back push the ones in the front. The ones in the front look around, and one kid calls out, "Miss Lacey?" A shadow in the window means Miss Lacey's watching, but the minute I look at her, she ducks out of sight. I motion to the kids, "Closer." The old rhyme about Georgie Porgy, I tell them, is really about England's King George IV, who could just never get enough. "Enough what?" a kid says. And I say, "Ask your teacher." Miss Lacey continues to lurk. I say, "You like the fire I got here?" And nod at the flames. Well, people need to clean the chimney all the time. Only the chimneys are really small inside, and they run all over the place. So people used to force little boys to climb up in them and scrape the insides. And since this was such a tight place, I tell them, the little boys would get stuck if they wore any clothes. So just like Santa Claus, I say, they climbed up the chimney, I say, and I lift the hot poker from the fire, naked. I spit on the red end of the poker, and the spit sizzles loud in the quiet room. "And you know how they died?" I say. "Anybody?" No hands go up. I say, "You know what a scrotum is?" Nobody says yes, or even nods, so I tell them, "Ask Miss Lacey." Our special morning in the smokehouse, Miss Lacey was bobbing on my dog with a good mouthful of spit. Then we were sucking tongues, sweating hard and trading drool, and she pulled back for a good look at me. In the dim smoky light, those big fake plastic hams were hanging all around us. She's just swamped and riding my hand hard and breathing between each word. She wipes her mouth and asks if I have any protection. "It's cool," I tell her. "It's 1734, remember? 50% of all children died at birth." She puffs a limp strand of hair off her face and says, "That's not what I mean." I lick her right up the middle of her chest, up her throat, and then stretch my mouth around her ear. Still jacking her with my swamped fingers, I say, "So you have some evil affliction I should know about?" She's pulling me apart behind, and she wets a finger in her mouth and says, "I believe in protecting myself." And I go, "That's cool." I say, "I could get canned for this," and roll a rubber down my dog. She worms her wet finger up my pucker and slaps my ass with her other hand and says, "How do you think I feel?" To keep from triggering, I'm thinking of dead rats and rotten cabbage and pit toilets. And I say, "What I mean is, latex won't be invented for another century." With a poker, I point at the fourth graders and I say, "These little boys used to climb out of the chimneys covered with black soot, and the soot used to grind into their hands and knees and elbows, and nobody had soap, so they stayed black all the time. This was their whole lives back then. Every day somebody forced them up a chimney, and they spent all day crawling along in the darkness with the soot getting in their mouths and noses, and they never went to school, and they didn't have television or video games or mango papaya juice boxes, and they didn't have music or remote-controlled anything or shoes, and every day was the same. These same little boys," I say, and wave the poker across the crowd of kids. "These were little boys just like you. They were exactly like you." My eyes go from each kid to each kid, touching all their eyes for a moment. And one day, each little boy would wake up with a sore place on his private parts, and these sore places didn't heal. And then they metastasized and followed the seminal vesicles up into the abdomen of each little boy. And by then, I say, it was too late. Here's the flotsam and jetsam of my medical school education. And I tell how sometimes they tried to save the little boy by cutting off his scrotum, but this was before hospitals and drugs. In the 18th century, they still called this kind of tumors soot warts. And those soot warts, I tell kids, were the first form of cancer ever invented. Then I ask, does anybody know why it was called cancer? No hands. I say, don't make me call on somebody. Back in the smokehouse, Miss Lacey was running her fingers through the clumps of her damp hair and said, "So?" As if it's just an innocent question, she says, "You have a life outside of here?" And wiping my armpits dry with my powdered wig, I say, "Let's not pretend, okay?" She's bunching up her pantyhose, the way women do so they can snake their legs inside, and says, "This kind of anonymous sex is a symptom of a sex addict." I'd rather think of myself as a playboy, James Bond type of guy. And Miss Lacey says, "Well, maybe James Bond was a sex addict." Here I'm supposed to tell her the truth. I admire addicts. In a world where everybody is waiting for some blind, random disaster or some sudden disease, the addict has a comfort of knowing what will most likely wait for him down the road. He's taken some control over his ultimate fate, and his addiction keeps the cause of his death from being a total surprise. In a way, being an addict is very proactive. A good addiction takes the guesswork out of death. There is such a thing as planning your getaway. And for serious, it's such a chick thing to think that any human life should just go on and on. See also Dr. Paige Marshall. See also Ida Mancini. The truth is, sex isn't sex, unless you have a new partner every time. The first time is the only session when your head and body are both there. Even the second hour of that first time, your head can start to wander. You don't get the full anesthetic quality of good first-time anonymous sex. What would Jesus not do? But instead of all that, I just lied to Miss Lacey and said, "How do I reach you?" I tell the fourth graders, they call it cancer because when the cancer starts growing inside you, when it breaks through your skin, it looks like a big red crab. Then the crab breaks open, and it's all bloody and white inside. Whatever the doctors tried, I tell the silent little kids, every little boy would end up dirty and diseased and screaming in terrible pain. And who can tell me what happened next? No hands go up. "For sure," I say, "he died, of course." And I put the poker back in the fire. "So," I say, "any questions?" No hands go up, so I tell them about the fairly bogus studies where scientists shaved mice and smeared them with smegma from horses. This was supposed to prove foreskins caused cancer. A dozen hands go up, and I tell them, "Ask your teacher." What a frigging job that must have been, shaving those poor mice, then finding a bunch of uncircumcised horses. The clock on the mantel shows our half hour is almost over. Out through the window, Denny's still bent over in the stocks. He's only got until 1 o'clock. A stray village dog stops next to him and lifts its leg, and a stream of steaming yellow goes straight into Denny's wooden shoe. And what else, I say, is George Washington kept slaves and didn't ever chop down a cherry tree, and he was really a woman. As they push toward the door, I tell them, "And don't mess with the dude in the stocks anymore," I shout, "and lay off shaking the damn chicken eggs." Just to stir the turd, I tell him to ask the cheesemaker why his eyes are all red and dilated. Ask the blacksmith about the icky lines going up and down the inside of his arms. I call after the infectious little monsters. Any moles or freckles they have, that's just cancer waiting to happen. I call after them, "Sunshine is your enemy. Stay off the sunny side of the street." Chapter 29. After Denny's moved in, I find a block of salt and pepper granite in the fridge. Denny lugs home chunks of basalt, his hands stained red with iron oxide. He wraps his pink baby blanket around black granite cobbles and smooth-washed river rocks and slabs of sparkling mica quartzite and brings them home on the bus. All those babies that Denny adopts, a whole generation piling up. Denny carts home sandstone and limestone, one blocky, soft pink armload at a time. In the driveway, he hoses the mud off them. Denny stacks them behind the sofa in the living room. He stacks them in the kitchen corners. Every day, I come home from a hard day in the 18th century, and here's a big lava rock on the kitchen counter next to the sink. There's this little gray boulder on the second shelf down in the fridge. "Dude," I say, "why is there a rock in the fridge?" Denny's here in the kitchen, taking warm rocks out of the dishwasher and swiping them with a dish towel, and he says, "Because that's my shelf, you said so," he says, and that's not just a rock, that's granite. But why in the fridge, I go? And Denny says, because the oven is already full. The oven is full of rocks, the freezer is full, the kitchen cabinets are so full they're coming off the wall. The plan was only one rock each day, but Denny's got such an addictive personality. Now he has to cart home a half dozen rocks every day just to maintain his habit. Every day the dishwasher is running, and the kitchen counters are spread with my mom's good bath towels, covered with rocks so they can air dry. Round gray rocks, square black rocks, broken brown and streaked yellow rocks, travertine limestone. Every new batch that Denny brings home, he loads in the dishwasher and throws the clean, dry rocks from the day before into the basement. At first, you can't see the basement floor because of all the rocks. Then the rocks are piling up around the bottom step. Then the basement's filled to halfway up the stairs. Now you open up the basement door, and the rocks piled inside spill out into the kitchen. Anymore, there is no basement. Dude, the place is filling up, I say. It feels like we're living in the bottom half of an hourglass, like somehow we're running out of time, being buried alive. Denny, in his dirty clothes, his waistcoat coming apart under the arms, his cravat hanging in shreds, he waits at each bus stop, cradling each pink bundle against his chest. He bounces each armload when the muscles in his arms start to fall asleep. After the bus comes, Denny, with dirt smeared on his cheeks, snores, leaned against the drumming steel wall inside the bus, still holding his baby. At breakfast, I say, dude, you said your plan was one rock each day. And Denny says, that's all I do, just one. And I say, dude, you are such a junkie. I say, don't lie. I know you're doing at least 10 rocks a day. Putting a rock in the bathroom, in the medicine cabinet, Denny says, okay, so I'm a little ahead of schedule. There's rocks hidden in the toilet tank, I tell him. And I say, just because it's rocks doesn't mean this still isn't substance abuse. Denny, with his runny nose, with his shaved head, his baby blanket wet in the rain, he waits at each bus stop, coughing. He shifts the bundle from arm to arm. With his face tucked in close, he pulls up the pink satin edge of the blanket. To better protect his baby, this looks like, but really to hide the fact that it's volcanic tufa. The rain's running off the back of his tricorner hat. Rocks tear out the inside of his pockets. Inside his sweaty clothes, carrying all that weight, Denny keeps getting skinnier and skinnier. Heaving around what looks like a baby, it's just a waiting game until somebody in the neighborhood gets him nailed for child abuse and neglect. People are just itching to declare somebody an unfit parent and put some kid in a foster home, but hey, that's just been my experience. Every night, I come home from a long evening of choking to death, and there's Denny with some new rock, quartz or agate or marble, feldspar or obsidian or argillite. Every night I come home from forging heroes out of nobodies, and the dishwasher's running. I still have to sit down and do the day's accounts, total the checks, send today's thank you letters. A rock sitting in my chair, my papers and stuff on the dining room table, it's all covered with rocks. At first I tell Denny, no rocks in my room. He can put the rocks anywhere else, put them in the hallways, put them in the closets. After that I'm saying, just don't be putting rocks in my bed. But you never sleep on that side, Denny says. I say that's not the point. No rocks go in my bed, that's the point. I come home from a couple hours of group therapy with Nico or Lisa or Tanya, and there's rocks inside the microwave oven. There's rocks in the clothes dryer, rocks inside the washing machine. Sometimes it's 3 or 4 in the morning before Denny's in the driveway hosing off a new rock. Some nights a rock so big he has to roll it inside. Then he's piling it on top of the other rocks in the bathroom, in the basement, in my mom's room. This is Denny's full-time occupation, this hustling rocks home. Denny's last day at work, at his banishment, his royal colonial governorship stood at the doors to the customs house and read from a little leather book. His hands almost hid the little thing, but it was black leather with the pages edged with gold paint and a few ribbons dangled from the top at the spine, one black, one green, and one red ribbon. Like the smoke vanisheth, so shall thou drive them away, and like as wax melteth at the fire, he read, so let the ungodly perish at the presence of God. Denny leaned closer to me and said, "The part about the smoke and the wax," Denny said, "I think he means me." At 1 o'clock in the town square, His Lord High Charlie, the colonial governor, was reading to us, standing with his face bowed into his little book. A cold wind pulled the smoke out sideways from every chimney pot. The milkmaids were there, cobblers were there, the blacksmith was there, all of them, their clothes and hair, their breath and wigs, reeking of hash, reeking of reefer, all their eyes, red and wasted. Goodwife Lanson and Mistress Plain wept into their aprons, but only because mourning was part of their job descriptions. A guard of men stood with muskets braced in both hands, ready to escort Denny into the wilderness of the parking lot. The colonial flag snapped, lowered to half-mast, at the peak of the customs house roof. A crowd of tourists watched from behind their video cameras. They're eating popcorn out of boxes, with the mutant chickens pecking crumbs at their feet. They're sucking cotton candy off their fingers. "Instead of banishing me," Denny calls out, "maybe I could just get stoned." He said, "I mean the rocks would make a nice going-away present." All the wasted colonists jumped when Denny said stoned. They looked at the colonial governor, and then looked at their shoes, and it took a little bit for the red to drain out of their cheeks. "We therefore commit this body to the earth to be turned into corruption," the governor read, as a jetliner roared low, coming in for a landing, drowning out his speech. The guard escorted Denny to the gates of Colonial Dunsborough, two lines of men with guns marching with Denny between them. Through the gates, through the parking lot, they marched him to the bus stop on the edge of the 21st century. "So, dude," I shout from the colony gates, "now that you're dead, what are you going to do with all your free time?" "It's what I'm not going to do," Denny says. "I'm sure as hell not going to act out." This meant hunting rocks instead of jacking off, staying so busy, hungry, tired, and poor, he won't have any energy left to hunt porno and wham the ham. The night after he's banished, Denny shows up at my mom's house with a rock in his arms and a policeman beside him. Denny wipes his nose on his sleeve. The cop says, "Excuse me, but do you know this man?" Then the cop says, Victor Mancini. Hey, Victor, how's it going? Your life, I mean." And he holds one hand up with the big flat palm facing me. I figure the cop means for me to high-five him, so I do, but I have to jump a little since he's so tall. Still, my hand misses his. Then I say, "Yeah, that's Denny. It's okay. He lives here." Talking to Denny, the cop says, "Get this. I saved this guy's life, and he don't even remember me." "Of course. That time I almost choked," I say, and the cop says, "You remember?" "Well," I say, "thanks for bringing old Denny here home safe and sound." I pull Denny inside and go to close the door. And the cop says, "You doing okay now, Victor? Is there anything you need?" I go to the dining room table and write a name on a slip of paper. I hand it to the cop and say, "Could you arrange to make this guy's life a living hell? Maybe you could pull some strings and get him in for a rectal cavity search." The name on the piece of paper is His Lord High Charlie, the colonial governor. What would Jesus not do? And the cop smiles and says, "I'll see what's possible." And I shut the door in his face. Now Denny heaves the rock onto the floor, and he asks, "Do I have a couple of bucks to spare? There's a ashlar granite at a stone supply yard. Good building rock. Rock with good compression strength. Costs so much per ton." And Denny figures he can get this one rock for $10. "A rock is a rock," he says, "but a square rock is a blessing." The living room looks filled up by an avalanche. First, the rocks were piled up around the bottom of the sofa. Then the end tables were buried with just the lampshades poking up out of the rocks. Granite and sandstone, gray and blue and black and brown rocks. In some rooms, we walk around stooped against the ceiling. So I ask, "What's he going to build?" And Denny says, "Give me the $10, Denny says, "and I'll let you help." "All these stupid rocks," I say, "what's your goal?" "This isn't about getting something done," Denny says. "It's about the doing, you know, the process." "But what are you going to do with these rocks?" And Denny says, "I don't know until I collect enough." "But what's enough?" I say. "I don't know, dude," Denny says. "I just want the days of my life to add up to something." the way every day of your life, the way it can just disappear in front of the television. Denny says he wants a rock to show for each day, something tangible, just one thing, a little monument to mark the end of each day. Each day he doesn't spend jacking himself off. Tombstone isn't the right word, but it's the first word that comes to mind. This way, maybe my life will add up to something, he says, something that will last. I say there needs to be a 12-step program for rock addicts. And Denny says, as if that would help. He says, when was the last time you even thought about your fourth step? Chapter 30. The mommy and the stupid little shit-heel kid. They stopped at a zoo one time. This zoo was so famous, it was surrounded by acres of parking lot. This was in some city you can drive to, where a line of moms and kids were waiting to get inside with their money. This was after the false alarm at the police station, when the detectives let the kid go find the bathroom by himself, and outside parked at the curb was the mommy saying, "You want to help me liberate the animals?" This was the fourth or fifth time she came back to claim him. This is what the courts would later call reckless abuse of city property. That day, the mommy's face looked the same as those dogs, where the corner of each eye turns down and too much skin makes the eyes look sleepy. "A damn St. Bernard," she said, with the rearview mirror pointed at herself. She'd got a white t-shirt somewhere she'd started wearing that said "Troublemaker." It was new but already had some nose blood on one sleeve. The other moms and kids all just talked to each other. The line went on for a long, long time. No police were around that they could see. While they stood, the mommy said, "If you ever want to be the first person to board an airplane, and if you want to travel with your pet, you can do both, easy. The airlines have to let crazy people carry their animals in their laps. The government says so." This was more important information to live by. Waiting in line, she gave him a few envelopes and address labels to stick together. Then she gave him some coupons and letters to fold and put inside. "You just call the airline people," she said, "and tell them you need to bring your comfort animal." That's really what airlines call them. It can be a dog, a monkey, a rabbit, but no way can it be a cat. The government doesn't consider a cat as comforting anybody. "The airline can't ask you to prove you're crazy," the mommy said. "It would be discrimination. You wouldn't ask a blind person to prove they were blind." "When you're crazy," she said, "how you look or act is not your fault." The coupon said, "Good for one free meal at the Clover Inn." She said crazy people and crippled people get first dibs on airline seats, so you and your monkey will be right in the front of the line, no matter how many people were ahead of you. She twisted her mouth off to one side and sniffed hard through that nostril. Then she twisted the other way and sniffed again. One hand was always around her nose, touching it, rubbing it. She pinched the tip. She smelled underneath her shiny new fingernails. She looked up at the sky and sniffed a drop of blood back in. Crazy people, she said, had all the power. She gave him stamps to lick and stick on the envelopes. The line moved a little bit at a time, and at the window, the mommy said, "Could I have a tissue, please?" She handed the stamped envelopes into the window and said, "Would you mind mailing these for us?" Inside the zoo were animals behind bars, behind thick plastic, across deep ditches filled with water, and the animals mostly just sprawled on the ground, pulling on themselves between their back legs. "For crying out loud," the mom said, too loud. "You give a wild animal a nice, clean, safe place to live, and you give it plenty of healthy food," she said, "and this is how it rewards you." The other moms leaned down to whisper to their kids, then pulled them off to go look at other animals. In front of them, monkeys shook themselves and squirted out spurts of thick white junk. The junk ran down the inside of the plastic windows. Old white junk was already there, splashed out thin and dried to almost see-through. "You take away their struggle to survive, and this is what you get," the mommy said. "How porcupines get off," she said while they watched, "was porcupines hump a stick of wood. The same way a witch rides a broom, porcupines rub a stick until it's stinking and gummy with their pee and juice from their glands. After it stinks enough, they'll never leave it for another stick. still watching the porcupine ride its stick, the mommy said, "And such a subtle metaphor." The little boy pictured them letting all the animals loose, the tigers and penguins, and all of them fighting, the leopards and the rhinos biting each other. The little fuck was really hot about the idea. "The only thing that separates us from the animals," she said, "is we have pornography. Just more symbols," she said. She wasn't sure if this made us better than the animals or worse. "Elephants," the mommy said, "can use their trunks. Spider monkeys can use their tails." The little boy just wanted to see something dangerous go wrong. "Masturbation," the mommy said, "is their only means of escape. Until us," the boy thought. The sad, transed-out animals, the cross-eyed bears and gorillas and otters all hunched over themselves, their glassy little eyes almost closed, almost not breathing. Their tired little paws were gummy, their eyes all crusty. "Dolphins and whales will rub themselves against the smooth sides of their tank," the mommy said. "Deer will rub their antlers in the grass until," she said, "they orgasm." Right in front of them, a Japanese sun bear tossed its little mess into the rocks. Then the bear sprawled backwards, with its eyes closed, its little puddle left to die in the sunlight. The boy whispered, "Is it sad?" "Worse," the mommy said. She told about a famous killer whale who was in a movie and then got moved to a fancy new aquarium but wouldn't stop messing its tank. The keepers were so embarrassed. This went on so much, now they were trying to set the whale free. "Masturbating your way to freedom," the mommy said. "Michel Foucault would have loved that." She said when a boy and a girl dog copulate, the head of the boy's penis swells and the vaginal muscles of the girl constrict. Even after sex, both dogs remain locked together, helpless and miserable for a brief period of time. The mommy said this same scenario described most marriages. By then, the last remaining mothers had herded their children away. When the two of them were alone, the boy whispered, "How could they get the keys to set all the animals free?" And the mommy said, "Got them right here." In front of the monkey cage, the mommy reached into her purse and pulled out a handful of pills. Little round purple pills. She threw the handful through the bars, and the pills scattered and rolled. Some monkeys crawled down to look. For one scary moment, not whispering, the boy said, "Is it poison?" And the mommy laughed. "Now that's an idea," she said. "No, honey, we don't want to liberate the little monkeys too much." The monkeys were crowding now, eating the pills. And the mommy said, "Relax, kiddo." She dug into her purse and brought out the little white tube, the trichloroethane. "This," she said, and put one of the purple pills on her tongue. "This is just plain old garden variety LSD. Then she pushed the tube of trichloroethane up one side of her nose. Or maybe she didn't. Maybe it wasn't that way at all. Chapter 31. Denny's already sitting ringside in the dark, sketching on the yellow pad in his lap. 3.5 empty beer bottles on the table next to him. He doesn't look up at the dancer, a brunette with straight black hair, on her hands and knees. She snaps her head from side to side to whip the stage with her hair looking purple in the red light. With her hands, she smooths the hair back off her face and crawls to the edge of the stage. The music is loud dance techno mixed with samples of dogs barking, car alarms, Hitler youth rallies. You hear sounds of breaking glass and gunshots. You hear women screaming and fire engine sirens in the music. "Hey, Picasso," the dancer says, and she dangles her foot in front of Denny. Without looking up from his pad, Denny takes a buck out of his pants pocket and slips it between her toes. On the seat next to him is another rock wrapped in his pink blanket. "For serious, the world has gone wrong when we dance to fire alarms. Fire alarms don't mean fires anymore. If there were a real fire, they'd just have somebody with a nice voice announce, 'Buick station wagon, license number BRK-773, your lights are on.' In the event of a real nuclear attack, they'd just shout, 'Phone call at the bar for Austin Letterman. Phone call for Austin Letterman.' The world won't end with a whimper or a bang, but with a discreet, tasteful announcement, 'Bill Riverdale, phone call holding line 2, then nothing. With one hand, the dancer takes Denny's money from between her toes. She lies on her front, her elbows propped on the edge of the stage, squashing her breasts together, and says, "Let's see how it turned out." Denny makes a couple of fast lines and turns the pad for her to see, and she says, "That's supposed to be me?" "No," Denny says, and turns the pad back to study it himself. "It's supposed to be a composite order column, the way Romans made. See here," he says, and points to something with his smudged finger. "See how the Romans combined the volutes of the Ionic order with the Corinthian acanthus leaves, but still kept all the proportions the same?" The dancer, she's Cherry Dackery from our last visit here, only now her blonde hair's dyed black. On the inside of one thigh is a little round bandage. By now, I've walked up to look over Denny's shoulder, and I say, "Dude," and Denny says, "Dude," and I say, "It sounds like you've been at the library again." To Cherry, I say, "It's good you took care of that mole." Cherry Dackery swings her hair in a fan around her head. She bows, then throws her long black hair back over her shoulders. "And I tinted my hair," she says. With one hand, she reaches back for a few strands and holds them out near me, rubbing them between two fingers. "It's black now," she says. "I figured it's safer," she says, "since you told me that blondes have the highest amount of skin cancer." Me, I'm shaking each beer bottle, trying to find the one with any beer left to drink, and I look at Denny. Denny's sketching, not listening, not even here. Corinthian Tuscan composite architraves of the entablature? They should let some people into the library by prescription only. For serious, books about architecture are Denny's pornography. Yeah, first it's a few rocks, then it's fan tracery vaulting. My point is, this is America. You start out with hand jobs, then progress to orgies. You smoke some dope, and then the big H. This is our whole culture of bigger, better, stronger, faster. The key word is progress. In America, if your addiction isn't always new and improved, you're a failure. To Cherry, I tap my head. Then I point my finger at her. I wink and say, "Smart girl." She's trying to bend one foot behind her head and says, "You can't be too careful." Her bush is still shaved, her skin still freckled pink, her toenails are silver. The music changes to a blast of machine gun fire, then the whistle of falling bombs. And Cherry says, "Break time." She finds the slit in the curtain, and she's gone backstage. "Look at us, dude," I say. I find the last bottle of beer, and it's warm. I say, "All women have to do is to get naked, and we give them all our money. I mean, why are we such slaves?" Denny flips over the page on his pad and starts something new. I move his rock to the floor and sit down. "I'm just tired," I tell him. "It seems women are always bossing me around. First my mom, and now Dr. Marshall. In between, there's Nico and Lisa and Tanya to keep happy. Gwen, who wouldn't even let me rape her. They're all just in it for themselves. They all think men are obsolete, useless, as if we're just some sexual appendix. Just the life support system for an erection or a wallet. From now on," I say, "I'm not giving any more ground. I'm going on strike. From now on, women can open their own doors. They can pick up the check for their own dinners. I'm not moving anybody's big, heavy sofas, not anymore. No more opening stuck jar lids either. And never again am I going to put down another toilet seat. Hell, from now on, I'm peeing on every toilet seat." With two fingers, I give the waitress the international sign language for two more beers, please. I say, "Let's just see women try and get along without me. Let's just watch their little female world grind to a halt." The warm beer tastes from Denny's mouth, his teeth and chapstick. That's how bad I need to drink right now. And for real, I say, "If I'm on a sinking ship, I'm getting in the lifeboat first. We don't need women. There are plenty other things in the world to have sex with. Just go to a sexaholics meeting and take notes. There's microwave watermelons. There's the vibrating handles of lawnmowers right at crotch level. There's vacuum cleaners and beanbag chairs. Internet sites. All those old chat room sex hounds pretending to be 16-year-old girls. For serious, old FBI guys make the sexiest cyber babes. Please, just show me one thing in the world that is what you'd think." To Denny I say, this is me talking, I say, women don't want equal rights. They have more power being oppressed. They need men to be the vast enemy conspiracy. Their whole identity is based on it. And Denny turns just his head, owl-style, to look at me, his eyes bunched under his eyebrows, and he says, dude, you are spiraling out.